content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. We're reading from the October edition of Smithsonian. The article, Ray of Hope, Conservationists Aim to Save the Giant Fish, which faces threats from poachers for a reef manta ray like this one swooping in the Indian Ocean near the Maldives. Motion is life. Like many shark species, a manta ray must constantly move to avoid sinking and to keep oxygen-rich water flowing across its gills. And because it is a very large animal that depends on a very small, even microscopic, food source, plankton, the fish has to eat virtually all the time. Swimming through a plankton cloud, it opens its massive mouth, deploys special fins to funnel the seawater in, and filters out the tiny morsels with its comb-like gill plates. Those plates, made of cartilage, are lately a source of trouble. Poachers are killing reef manta rays to supply quacks who peddle the material in a bogus remedy. That practice, plus deliberate killing of the fish for food, unintentional capture in nets, boat strikes, and other threats, have reduced world population. Climate change looms as another challenge. The International Union for Conservation of Nature classifies the reef manta ray as vulnerable. Worry is justified. In the Sea of Cortez, aggressive overfishing wiped out local populations of two reef manta ray cousins, the oceanic manta ray and the devil ray, in just 20 years. Conservation groups are spurring research into the slow-growing giant, which can stretch 12 feet wingtip to wingtip, weigh 1,500 pounds, and live 40 years. It's a species that doesn't have any way of adapting to survive human pressures, says Joanna Harris, a researcher at Manta Trust, a UK-based nonprofit. The only way to halt the decline is to take action. Harris, a doctoral candidate at the University of Plymouth, is working to understand environmental cues that prompt the fish to migrate, sometimes hundreds of miles in search of food. How does it know where to go next and when? A change in wind direction, which affects surface currents, appears to play a role. She says government officials, conservationists, and scuba outfitters who lead reef manta ray watching trips could all use such information to benefit the animals. Protection seems to be the effective in the Maldives, where catching reef manta rays is prohibited and rangers limit access to certain lagoons when the animals aggregate to feed. The island chain plays host to the world's largest population of the majestic fish, with more than 5,000 individuals counted. The dark spot pattern on the underside of each one is unique and serves as an ID. The reef manta ray in this photograph, according to a Manta Trust database, is a juvenile male. His name is Naba, N-A-B-A. That's by Terence Monmany. Up next, Sense and Sensibility. From the lab to the art gallery, the latest efforts to understand the fragrant, musky, stinky, and utterly baffling world of smell. By Abigail Tucker. Last winter, Andreas Keller decided the time was right to branch out from his day job as a neuroscientist and launch a new art gallery. Not just any gallery, but the country's first and only commercial space devoted entirely to smell-based art. He rented a defunct barbershop in New York City's Chinatown. And he teamed up with an artist named M. Daughtery for his inaugural show in February of 2021, drilling a hole in the exterior wall to pipe a piney perfume called Forest Bath to the street outside. The fresh evergreen mingled with steamed dumplings and ripe dumpsters and the smoldering papers that Keller's Chinese neighbors sometimes burned as an offering to their ancestors. The gallery had always been a fantasy, but the pandemic brought it into focus, says Keller, sitting in his astroturf-carpeted back office, which he soon plans to sprinkle with a molecule that smells like fresh-cut grass. Not only did lockdown allow contemplative hours away from his work, but one of early COVID-19's telltale symptoms gave him the hunch that there might, at long last, be a market for his dream. Olfaction has always been our underdog sense. It's both primitive and complex, which makes it hard to study, and harder still to transfer to our increasingly digital existence. Our scientific understanding of how smell works lags so far behind our grasp of hearing, and especially vision, and smells cannot at this point be recorded or emailed or Instagrammed. In one 2011 survey, more than half of young adults admitted that they would rather forfeit their ability to smell than their smartphones. But just when it seems that the nose could not recover from its nosedive, along came the coronavirus. Afflicted people, robbed of their sense of smell, realized that they couldn't register the smoke of fires actively burning down their house or the scent of their spouses, torpedoing marriages by some accounts, or even the savor of a candy bar, since many of what we think of as taste, like the flavor of chocolate, are actually smells. That stank, you don't know what you have until it's gone, Keller says. Even for those who avoided loss of smell, living in a world muffled by masks or reduced to deodorized Zoom calls heightened the collective desire to breathe deep and experience the scented realm anew. This likely explains the current perfume and home fragrance boom, and perhaps why so many curious passersby step inside Olfactory Art Keller, as the gallery is called. When you are asked to smell art, Keller says, you realize how impoverished your perception of the world is when you limit yourself to the visual. For several weeks, the gallery's windows were tin-foiled over to allow for full immersion in the aroma of old banana versus young banana, one artist wink at a classic Velvet Underground album cover. Or the visitor may get a whiff of a perfumer's interpretation of what a beaver might smell like to a dog. Marzipan, maybe? Or the orchid bee's homemade cologne, or George Washington's false teeth. During my visit, I'm instructed to massage a forest landscape that turns out to be a sort of a giant scratch-and-sniff sticker, unleashing a sudden rush of micro-encapsulated citrus, like jungle breath. Some people get very confused, Keller says. Normally, game gallery hoppers may back out onto the street. Then there's always somebody who can't smell anything and thinks it's a prank. A few banana phobes came out of the woodwork during the banana stunt, the fruity smell triggering some deep, unexpected revulsion. I am actually friends with one of these people, Keller notes. She moves to a different table if someone is eating a banana, and she refused to come to the show. Those visitors, willing and able to stay and ponder a scent by the name of Sinner, often bicker about what they are smelling. Is that kitchen disinfectant? Church incense? No. Tandoori chicken. These diverse personal responses are exactly what Keller had devoted much of his academic life to studying. why various individuals seem to perceive the same odors differently or interpret the same odors in different ways or not notice some of them at all. Such questions are at the heart of the larger problem of how smells are coded by the brain. How, for example, do a bunch of snorted up proteins and carbohydrates result in our tangy awareness of just baked sourdough, that pandemic crowd pleaser? It's making me hungry. Perhaps scientists will soon catch wind of the answers, as the pandemic has also brought a flood of new funding to this sometimes overlooked or perhaps undersniffed field. The future could be a heady place, characterized not only by redolent art galleries like Keller's, but also by the potential resurrection of technologies like smell-o-vision and the more recently fizzled O-phone by scent-based strategies to diagnose Parkinson's disease and treat post-traumatic stress disorder, by the launch of perfume dating apps and fragrant Instagram food pictures and virtual shopping services that can sniff out the ripest avocado from afar. Most urgently, tens of millions of otherwise recovered COVID-19 patients are still suffering from lasting olfactory problems. Many of these people are understandably discontented with the conventional wisdom that once a sense of smell disappears for 6 months, it's probably gone for good, and are now demanding new and better clinical approaches. The amount of research has just gone up exponentially, says Richard Doty, director of the University of Pittsburgh's Smell and Taste Center. It's a pretty big deal in terms of interest, but this is a complicated sensory system. Understanding it is pretty difficult. I don't think overnight we are going to have all the answers. Progress in this field may depend on unusual creativity and collaborations between perfumers and linguists, artists and engineers, and even perhaps anthropologists and foraging communities that have never before encountered a whiff of vanilla or Camembert cheese. Keller recently completed a PhD in philosophy, which he says complements his genetics PhD. Perception is a philosophical as well as a scientific problem, he says. The truth about smell seems to ambush and retreat, materialize and dissipate, like lilacs on a ticklish June breeze, or the ghost of yesterday's stir-fry. Why don't we know what the nose knows? The fundamentals of color vision were more or less established in the 19th century, when scientists discerned that all of the varied hues, from red to violet, are produced by just three types of receptors in human retinas. Taste depends on a whole order of magnitude more receptor types on our tongues, but still a reasonable amount. But the nose, or rather the clump of sensory neurons high inside your nostrils, boasts about 400 receptor types. In 2004, Richard Axel and Linda Buck were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, or medicine, for discovering the genes that encode these receptors, which sit on the surface of specialized neurons, allowing them to shoot information down leggy axons much deeper into the brain, to one of the two olfactory bulbs where smells are processed. But we still can't fathom which odors many of the individual's receptors recognize, let alone how they work in concert. If vision is the default sense for Homo sapiens, why do we need so many more olfactory receptors? It seems like too many, doesn't it? One smell researcher acknowledged. Light is electromagnetic radiation, and the same three color vision receptors can combine to process a range of wavelengths, covering the entire rainbow of visible light. But smells are not wavelengths coasting along a smooth spectrum. They involve a complex mix of chemical particles bobbing around in the air. Our bodies have built receptors that can recognize a number of oddball molecules volatile enough to waft up into our schnozzes, which means we need lots of options. For instance, the dreaded banana smell is a conglomerate of something like 20 or so molecules, each destined for overlapping sets of receptors, activating some and perhaps inhibiting others and striking all chords in the concerto that we somehow register as banana. In a 2014 paper for Science, Keller and colleagues at Rockefeller University estimated that humans can distinguish, give or take, at least a trillion distinct smells lurking here on planet Earth. Complicating matters further, our legions of odorant receptors have lots of variants, some of them less sensitive or fully non-functional in large chunks of the population. To begin his smell studies, Keller created mutant fruit flies by turning their olfactory receptors on and off, before realizing that his fellow New Yorkers were a sort of naturally occurring population of mutants, and much more diverse since they hailed from all corners of the world. Recruiting subjects via Craigslist and other methods, he administered a battery of smell tests to hundreds of people and collected spit samples for genetic sequencing. The idea was to link specific anosmias, as singular smell deficits are known, to corresponding receptors involved in their processing to figure out which of the 400-ish receptors did what and why people perceived or preferred certain smells. Once you find people with a non-functioning variant, Keller explains, you can study what that gene does for humans. The upshot is that you can expect about 30% of your receptor arsenal to function differently than your neighbors, which explains why conversations starting with, "Do you smell that?" so frequently devolve into farce, F-A-R-C-E. A substance like androstarin, a musk found in human sweat, truffles, and elsewhere, can smell like sandalwood, or urine, or nothing at all, depending on the nation, rather the nature, of the smeller. For a long time, researchers believed that, quote, asparagus pee wasn't universal because only certain people reported a malodorous bouquet after consuming the spiky veggie. In fact, only some unlucky noses can detect it. But for those who can, the odor is universal, a fact those subjects realized only when they smelled each other's urine, Keller says. Even professional perfumers sometimes need a helping nose when it's time to dose the cinnamon, for example. In addition to all those wonky odorant receptors, a bunch of which work in some people but not others, there are some 600 additional smell pseudodogenes that, at least as far as scientists can tell, don't code for working receptors in anybody alive today. Some researchers take this chunk of dormant DNA as evidence of the nose's terminal decline. Perhaps our sense of smell started eroding when we changed the way we select our mates, prioritizing other factors above scent. Such atrophy is not unheard of. Bottlenose dolphins and other toothed whales apparently relinquished olfaction long ago, possibly to free up headspace for echolocation. But other explanations circulate too. With so many smells in play, a single receptor deficit is rarely a death sentence, relaxing selection pressure on these genes. Although try telling that to 20% of the population that is oblivious to the bitter almond scent of cyanide. There is marked variability in other senses, to be sure. Some gifted people can discern subtler differences in color than the rest of us, while about 5% of the population is partially colorblind. But it's striking that pretty much everybody is noseblind to something or another, and usually to multiple things, be it freesia or wet basement or cilantro. Often our commonplace specific anomias are starker than the gaps in our other senses. While a colorblind person might insist that grass is red instead of green, a noseblind person essentially perceives no grass at all. Here's where that philosophy degree might come in handy. Or to return to the technical, someone with less sensitive version of odorant receptor, OR2J3, related to the ability to smell low concentrations of cis-3-hexan-1-OL. The grassy-smelling molecule might be oblivious when Keller finally gets around to perfuming his astroturf. To learn more about our own sense of smell, I swung by Philadelphia's Monell Chemical Senses Center, home base of Joel Mainland, a star in this field and Keller's frequent collaborator, at least before the downtown art scene tempted him away. While Mainland has not yet opened his own avant-garde gallery, in his lab I detected a by now familiar blurring of art and science. He described one graduate school experiment that sounded more like experimental theater, in which he was blindfolded and headphoned and instructed to follow a scent through the grass of a public park. It was part of a test to see if humans could track canine style by scent alone. It turns out they could, but not nearly as well as dogs. When the scenario was repeated with a duck corpse, two actual dogs in the park intervened, charging past the slower moving human smellers to prove their superiority. At present, the tools of Mainland's trade include sleep apnea masks and a fake plastic proboscis that looks as if it's been ripped off a Groucho Marx mask, although really it's repurposed from a commercial contraption called the Nasal Ranger, designed to help humans track offensive and potentially dangerous odors. Mainland modifies these gizmos to deliver odors in reliable quantities to human subjects, a tricky task indeed. Vision scientists can grab a standard color monitor off the shelf at Best Buy to display the colors and images they want, which can then be easily shared with subjects and colleagues worldwide. But there is just not a great way for you and me to communicate about smells without being in the same room. Mainland said, and even then, it's touch and go. Odors cannot so far be stored electronically, and of course they constantly drift off and degrade in a most demoralizing manner. Capturing and keeping them is an art form in and of itself. To evoke a smoky essence, lab members used an infuser to warm cotton balls, then store the cotton balls in a tightly sealed container to use as a training tool for experiment volunteers. A jar marked animal holds harvested horse sweat, while Mainland is not asked with catching lightning in a bottle, he does somehow need to entrap ozone. that fresh, elusive, post-electrical storm smell. I pointedly did not ask about the contents of the jar marked fecal, though I know it could be worse. Other lab stock, a man-made compound called U.S. Government Standard Bathroom Malodor, based on real-life military latrines that colloquially known as stench soup. Mainland decanted some liquid samples for me. He did so with very careful hands, as he, like many in his field, has nightmarish tales about accidents that befoul laboratory air for days. Mainland once fumbled a vial of vile grapefruit mercaptan, which smells like sulfur crossed with fruit snacks. For Keller, it was popcorn like dilactyl. Right off the bat, I picked up on a smoked sausage vibe, which some people find to be overpowering and repulsive, but just made me kind of hungry. Then we moved on to musks. One smelled powdery and sweet, a little like Necco wafers, but mostly I drew blanks, performing about as well as a bottlenose dolphin. "Try this guy," Mainland said, uncorking another. "I have no idea," I stammered, after a few deep, desperate breaths of what seems like nothing. "Plant water, I guess? Dog breath?" He gave me a sharp look. "It's inconceivable that you can't smell musks." Then again, it was possible that some of these samples had decayed past the point of potency. Short of sampling my genome, we may never know, as Mainland has previously established that he himself cannot detect some of these substances. It could be a classic case of the nose blind leading the nose blind. Just a few weeks before my visit, Mainland's lab with Keller and other co-authors published a paper on the genetics of musk sensitivity. The work was partially funded by the beauty and personal care company Unilever. The global fragrance industry has been intoxicated by the notion that the genetics of smell could help them to entice heretofore reluctant consumers. A lot of companies came to us, Mainland recalls, and said, "We have a lot of trouble making fragrances for the Asian market. Can you tell us which fragrances are going to be most liked by them by looking at their olfactory receptors?" To that end, the researchers asked 1,000 Han Chinese to rate a handful of common odors. And there's our cue. We're out of time for this week's reading. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.